if you thought it would be done by 10, but that is what's happening.
No problem. Okay. Okay, let's read this. Sandra, will you read 19 and 20, please?
Then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God.
Okay, we're talking in this particular question about what we can do to build or to increase an attitude of forgiveness in our hearts. So we're not prone to withholding forgiveness. So we're open to it and able to do it when it's required. So what did y'all put down for here?
Well, I think the context here is how they should behave in the midst of trials. And they need to behave so that the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. They need to forgive one another, and that glorifies God.
And be quick to hear and slow to speak and slow to anger. You know, so often we're ready to jump to conclusions, or we, you know, are in times of trial. We want to talk and fire up our anger before we maybe have all the information, or before we have time to reflect on God's word and get ourselves under control and pray about it, as he talks about later, you know, in the chapters. And so, you know, to be slow to anger and quick to hear, you know, and
basically hold your tongue, right? We talked about several instances last week in particular about about how, if it's natural for human beings to be this way. Mm-hmm. And I personally think, well, maybe it's just me in my case, it needs training or concentrating on it so you do that. I mean, I don't think it comes natural to me anyway to be slow to speak. You know, it usually just pops right out, whatever I think, in some occasions. But
and there in chapter 4:11, he says, do not speak against one another. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother. And this is hypocritical judgment, you know. And so, and he talks about bridling his tongue later on.
Right. There's a lot of that in this book, isn't there?
Yes, it is.
So this is just something we can work on. Maybe it's not natural to us. Maybe we're not great at it, but we can hopefully work on that with the encouragement and help of our brethren or whoever we rely on. I did make a note about, Sandra, what you said about the wrath of man does not, you said to make sure that the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. I took that as kind of sarcastic, saying that the wrath of man, I mean, it's like he's meaning the opposite of what he says. I mean, he's like, don't kid yourself. The wrath of man sure isn't going to produce the righteousness of God. I don't think anybody's goal is to. Okay, back up. I just think it's being sarcastic. What do y'all think? I didn't quite understand exactly how Sandra thinks. So we don't produce our wrath doesn't produce the righteousness of God. I don't see how wrath of man produces righteousness of God.
No, mine says
all.
Does not. Mine says, for the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. So if we go around with an angry attitude and just flying off the handle and not showing any kind of restraint, we are not going to be right with God, because our mouth and our attitude is going to get us in trouble.
Okay.
Right, so the second part's really explaining why.
Not to prevent it, not to prevent the second part, but this is, you know, it's not going to produce the results you want. It's not going to get you in good with it, man, for one thing, or God. You know, it's not going to make us the way, it's not going to help our relationship with God as far as our righteousness is concerned. Does that make sense? Okay. All right, let's look at James 4, which Linda's already referred to. We're not going to read this whole thing because I think everybody's pretty familiar. Oh wait, no. This is not what I thought it was. I was starting to say it's the tongue, but that's chapter 3. What is the focus on here in this reading that will help us to be more willing to forgive? What do we need to have in ourselves?
Humility.
That's exactly what I put. And even in verse, I put that it cures worldliness, and I didn't make a note of whether or not that was a quote or if that was just I can't think of any words today. Conclusion, my conclusion of what it says in this passage. Also, I made a note that submission to God, you know, in an humble way will eliminate pride. That will help us keep our pride under control or eliminate it completely if we're lucky. Any other comment on that? Linda, what did you say a while ago about verse 11? About speaking evil of one another?
Yes.
If we keep Philippians 2 in our hearts, you know, it's two lessons out. If we keep in our heart an attitude that putting others above ourselves to give them the prominence over ourselves, the preeminence, or, you know, put their wants and wishes or their welfare above our own, then we're not going to have trouble with humility or pride, and we'll be able to think before our mouth shoots off something, well, this might hurt their feelings, maybe I shouldn't say it. Or this might cause more negative results than positive. Okay? What else do y'all want to have to say on that?
You mentioned, I have materialism. You mentioned, did you say worldliness?
Yeah, I put that if we focus on humility, that can cure worldliness.
Well, verse 3 talks about spend it on your pleasures. And then verse 4 says, friendship with the world is enmity with God. So I have materialism there also.
Okay, as far as removing it?
Yes.
Okay.
Being humble with God will cure that and focusing on the right things.
Okay, that's why I was going back to that, because in verse 8 where it's talking about God resisting the proud and giving grace to the humble, you know, if we are humble, then we can, that's verse 4 is right before that, you're right.
And you know, verse 7 and 8 says, you can take it as prayer or you can take it as an attitude of wanting to be more like God and drawing near to him. But it says to cleanse your hands and purify your hearts and be miserable and warm and weak. It's talking about, and number 9, it's talking about repenting. You know, we need to work on our hearts. We need to repent and change the things that we do wrong and pray, you know, that we do better. And because we need to have forgiveness ourselves, but we need, the humble, I mean, we need to look at ourselves, you know, and fix what's wrong with ourselves instead of just being out there, as it goes on to say, judging others and looking at others and being so puffed up in our own little self that we're not looking and correcting the things ourselves.
Okay. And if, you know, if we also carry it far enough to think, you know, I might be guilty of that one day and I might want somebody to forgive me, we can, you know, think in that kind of frame of mind, that would help there also. I think that goes along with Philippians 2 as well. All right, let's turn over to 1 John 1. Nisha, will you read 8 through 10, please?
If we say that we have no sin, we're deceiving ourselves, and the truth is not in us. If we confess our sins, He is faithful and righteous to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. If we say that we have not sinned, we make Him a liar, and His word is not in us.
I kind of gave a little preview of this at the end of the last verse, where I was talking to remember that, you know, we may need forgiveness for that same sin sometime. We need to remember that we also sin. And we need forgiveness as well. So, you know, we wouldn't want somebody to withhold that from us, most specifically God. So we need to be aware of the other person's attitude, especially one who is asking for forgiveness. And if they're not, then maybe, you know, they could use some help in seeing that they maybe need to change something, which is another topic. We could study that somewhere else, but I think my focus here on this particular passage was that, you know, we sin and need forgiveness ourselves. So how can we withhold that from other people? Anybody else want to comment on that? All right. Okay, let's go to the next one. As I told y'all last week, this is one that I actually said myself. And it's the example of Samuel and Eli and his son is not sons is not one where Eli said, "Well, my kids will never do that," or Samuel either, for that matter. I don't know that Samuel was even married, but I just use this passage as an example of how your kids cannot be doing what they ought to be doing, and whether you do something about it or not. In this case, Eli did not. But then we're going to look at what we can do to make sure that our kids are behaving themselves in a way that's in line with God's will, and whether they're children or after they're grown. And, I mean, I prepare them for doing that after they're grown, not that we can control that after they're grown. Sorry, I didn't mean to say it that way. But that's the focus of this lesson. But I just thought it was kind of funny to use that, not funny, but it'd be interesting to see what y'all's comments were. Has anybody here ever said that? Besides me?
No, I've said it.
You know, before I had kids, I knew what my kids were going to do and not do. It's real easy to say then, and that's mostly when I said it. Because, you know, you see somebody's kids that are doing something that you're just horrified. Just for an example, we had some people over one time, and their kids who were, I don't know, 6 to 8, 5 maybe range, they got underneath the bed and pulled, you know, old-timey box springs had this funny gauze kind of stuff on it. They just ripped that all off in strips. I just couldn't believe it. How does anybody's kids do that? I thought, you know, and that, of course, I said my kids will never do that, but by that point, they wasn't even there to be done to. But the problem was the parents weren't watching them, or they hadn't been told to not bother things that weren't theirs or whatever. But I'm sure there were other examples where I saw things that I was horrified by, and I think it made me harder on my kids probably than I might have been, because I saw so many little wild animal kids. You know, that tends to make us sometimes make sure not want our kids to act like that. All right, let's look at 1 Samuel 2. In this particular case, there's several lessons here, in my opinion. You know, the example, the reason I chose to discuss Samuel's exposure to this to Eli is because of his relationship with Eli. What was their relationship?
They were close.
Right.
Eli was the priest, and Samuel was in his care, actually, after his
from a very young age. Very young age. So he has to have seen all this, the way Eli's sons behaved. I don't think there's any, I'm not aware of any example where Samuel had sin in his life. He's human, and obviously he sinned, but I don't know of anything specific. You know, he's more in the Joseph category, that he was, you know, right on track all the time. I mean, unless I'm just missing it, I didn't spend a whole lot of time looking for that. But he did grow up in a house with a man who raised these other kids who were not behaving for themselves, and they were grown. But we see here, we're going to see here, that Eli had some responsibilities even after they were grown. So I don't want to read the whole thing. There's a whole lot of it here. Hopefully you all read it. What exactly were the sons doing, Hophni and Phinehas, that they shouldn't have been doing?
You mean like doing the customs of the priest? They weren't
right.
Doing the customs of the priest,
right.
And they were taking most of the sacrifice, grabbing as much of it as they
right.
could themselves.
Right. Yes, they were taking them. They wanted the meat raw. They didn't want the fat burned off. They wanted the best of it, and they forced the people to give it to them. And what else? At the door of the tabernacle. They had no shame at all. They were just wild. They were running completely wild, with obviously no restraint. Samuel.
Interesting to see that they did not know the Lord. That's the thing that bothered me.
Well, that's the problem. That's the underlying problem.
Right. But, you know, surely they knew the Lord because they were there. You know, they knew who the Lord was. Eli was serving the Lord in the priesthood.
Well, don't you think that means like people we all know who were raised and taught about the Lord and who live ungodly lives, and I think they would be categorized as not knowing the Lord. I think it means they just choose to pay no attention to him or reject his will. Right, completely. Yes, revere. It's not a factor in their lives as far as making decisions or behavior or treatment of other people or anything. They're those kind of people that are completely self-absorbed and don't care what anybody thinks. first and foremost the Lord. You know, if they don't care what the Lord thinks, why are they going to care what anybody else thinks? They're just going to do what they want. And some people are, I think, are raised in a manner that shoots them that direction. Some people have defining events in their lives that cause them to, you know, make a 180-degree turnaround. You know, who knows? You can. There's all kinds of explanations for it, but and sometimes there's not. But let's see back to this. Samuel is the one who delivered the prophecy of judgment to Eli. And how old was he? Do we know? I don't think we know specifically, but was he grown up? He was young.
Yes.
He was very young. Because he didn't know what, it was before he knew God. It was before he knew that he had been chosen and that was actually God speaking to him. So,
He didn't want to tell Eli.
Right, yeah. After Eli told him to go back and listen to the whole thing, he did not. He knew it wasn't good. He knew enough to know it wasn't going to be good. And obviously, later on, we know that Samuel was very straight arrow as far as, you know, doing what God expected him to do. He he anointed kings. He was a prophet. He told King Saul when he was wrong, and he knew God and lived walking with God. But as a result of this particular event, what might he have, what happened to Hophni and Phinehas, what might he have learned about God and his promises?
They come true.
Right. He saw that happen.
And he also saw Eli's failure to rebuke his son.
Right. And the consequences of that.
Yeah. And God's rebuke of him because of that.
Right.
Even though they were grown, and even though, you know, they were responsible for their own sin, God held Eli responsible for his part in it.
Right, he did. Okay, let's look at chapter 2, verse 39. This to me, no, I'm sorry. Must be chapter 3. Oh, 29, I'm sorry, verse 29, 229. This to me is extremely scary. It says that a man of God is talking to Eli. Why do you kick at my sacrifice and my offering which I have commanded in my dwelling place and honor your sons more than me? How did he do that?
By letting them get away with the things they were doing. He was giving them... he wasn't honoring God by letting his children do what he shouldn't be doing.
The rest of that verse says, to make yourselves fat with the best of all the offerings of Israel, my people. I take that to mean that he was taking advantage of his sons, taking the best and the best parts of the meat and the better part of the meat, the bigger part of it. So he was allowing he was putting his sons above God. And that is something that, you know, it's a scary thing. It would be a scary position to find myself in. But I think we see people doing that a lot. So it's just something to think about. And then the house of Eli says it's going to be cursed. Behold, 31, the days are coming that I'll cut off your arm, the arm of your father's house. There will not be an old man in your house. So, in other words, and then he goes on to say, you know, what's going to happen to the sons. Now look over at verse 13 of chapter 3. And it says, I have told him, this is God talking to Samuel. I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows. This isn't just judgment on Eli. Who else is going to benefit from this judgment? His whole family, his house. Because his sons made themselves vile and he did not restrain them. Okay, I don't know that this necessarily means that any parent can restrain adult children or change their behavior, but what in particular about this case makes us know that he can? What was Eli's position?
Yes, he was the priest.
He was the priest. I think he was the high priest. He had all the means in the world to take care of this problem because these people were dishonoring God in the plain view of the entire nation of Israel. And he should have and did not do anything about it. He could have had them removed. He could have sent them off somewhere else. He could have done something because he was in a position of power. And because he did not, his sons died, and then, of course, he did too. In chapter 4, verse 11, they died when the ark was captured, and then when Eli heard the news, he fell off the log he was sitting on, and he died as well. It's just things to think about, I think, you know, when we're raising our children to never do whatever. You know, it's easy to say when they're 4, well, my kids aren't going to grow up and do that, isn't it? When they're 4 and cute and sweet and pliable. I mean, you're in control. But there comes a time when you're not in control, where they're adults and they have free moral agency. And there's often things you can do. I talked to somebody just recently that had been talking to their adult children about different issues. The child told her to her face she didn't believe all that, but she sat and listened out of respect for her mother. But the mother never stops trying to talk to her about what's going on in her life in a way that's not pleasing to God. So we do know we can do that. We can always do that. We can't always change the course of our children's lives. We can't do much of anything, can we, once they're grown? They're pretty much on their own.
And, you know, you see Eli at least talking to his sons, and sometimes we do talk to our son, our children, if we see them heading towards sin or, you know, that might lead to that.
Where do you see him talking to them?
Okay, I was trying to look it up. I'm sorry I didn't write it down.
I think it's around 225.
Yeah, somewhere on in there. And they did not listen.
Oh, you're right, he did. Why do you do such things?
Yes. Why do you do such things? And sometimes we might give lip service to it or talk to them a little bit. But like in the case of 1 Corinthians 5, maybe we don't rebuke. Rebuke is strong, you know. And instead of just encouraging them to do better. Or instead of... it sort of bothers me when I'm seeing you do, you know, just sort of talk to them a little bit instead of this is wrong and you need to repent and change and do right. And this is what you need to do. He didn't do that. And then he wouldn't listen. So here we already have sons who don't listen to their father. And that might have started back, you know, because you were talking about bringing our children up when they're 2 and 3 and 4. You know, make sure that they listen to us back then.
Right. They have to develop a respect for you early, or they aren't not going to listen to you when they're 17.
That's right.
Okay, anything else on Samuel and Eli and his sons before we move toward more generally raising our children to hopefully prevent these kind of issues? Obviously, this sin was you know, in your face and bold and pretty raucous sin here. You know, some people think there's different levels of sin. Some aren't as bad as others, but, you know, I don't. Sin is sin. But this, even in the case of hugely bold sin where it was affecting other people, Eli was expected to do something, to restrain them.
I did have one point, if I may. In chapter 8, 1 through 5, you know, we're talking about Samuel being married. Mm-hmm. Samuel's not only married,
he has sons. Oh, my goodness. How can I remember, forget that?
And
that's right. His sons were judges.
His own sons did not walk in Samuel's ways. But in chapter 12, we see Samuel doing what Eli did not do. Samuel rebukes Israel along with his sons and prays for them and tells them, you know, because this is when they've asked for a king. Because of Samuel's sons not doing and getting bribes and that kind of thing as the priest. And so Samuel, as good a father as he was, and how he stood before the Lord, and what he was, his own sons didn't follow in his ways.
Okay.
But he rebukes them.
Okay, well, that I'm really glad you brought that up, because that illustrates another point to me, that even good parents sometimes have kids that don't do that are not the way you raised them.
Right.
And, you know, the bottom line is to... You know, don't let that control your life or pull you in or that kind of thing.
Yes.
That's an excellent point. I'm glad you said that. I should have known that.
Wouldn't that go under number 4?
I put it first on
number
there.
Number 4.
Number 4 on your second page then.
Okay.
Or 3, number 4. Yeah.
Yes. Good. My mind was going off in other tracks and I didn't do Samuel at all. Okay. Let's look at Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9. Yes, we're starting the Old Testament. This is one of my absolute, to me, most important verses in the Bible. because it tells me what God expects of me. I mean, actually it's chapter 10, which is a similar thing that puts it in those words. Chapter 10, verse 12 says, "And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you?" That this is what he asks of you. This is what he wants of you. And I just use this in my life because I think there's enough of, you know, what the way God dealt with his people in Israel, and as a comparison to the way he dealt with Christians, with his children, that this is just as important under the new law as the old. Okay, so back to chapter 6, verse 4 through 9. I don't know if we'll read it all, but verse 5 says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength." And then the same as in chapter 10 where I just was. That's all he asks. Just love him. And what will come out of that if we love the Lord with all our heart, with all our soul, and all our strength? Where does that lead? Absolutely, to obedience. Okay, and then if you go on down, as far as having to do with this question, I mean, it's with parents' responsibilities to their children. Verse 7 says what?
Teach them diligently
to your children. And not just say, oh, by the way, you want to be sure and love the Lord. How do you teach them diligently in this passage?
Through your way of life. All walks of life.
Everything you're doing. When you're sitting down, when you're walking, when you're lying down. And the whole part about binding it as a sign on your hand, as front between your eyes, I don't think that's literal. I think that's talking about it should be in the forefront of your mind at all times and everything you do. Everything, you know, raising children is an opportunity to teach them. You know, things happen in their lives that you can say, well, you know, this is a Bible story. Say they're getting bullied at school. You know, talk to them about Joseph. He was mistreated, but he never failed the Lord. Proverbs 22:6, along this same line, says, train up a child the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. And the way he should go is what? Obviously.
Following after God's word.
This is our guidebook right here. I just think it would be horrible. A lot of people think, most people think in our society that nobody's going to tell me what to do. If I think it's okay, and I'm not hurting anybody, why not do it? But so basically, they are their own standard. And I mean, they're not following that train of thought all the way through to a logical conclusion, because if that's the case, everybody's got their own standards. So when you butt up against each other like this, who's going to be right? We have to have a standard, and I think it's a wonderful blessing that God gave us something to live by, to tell us what's right and what's wrong. Otherwise, I think probably most people are smart enough to figure out a lot of things, but we don't have to worry about that. That's already been done for us. And it's not even hard, because it all boils down to loving God with all your heart and loving your neighbor as yourself. All of it. Anything else on that one before we go to Proverbs 23? All right, let's look at Proverbs 23:13 and 14. Amanda, will you read that, please?
Do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you strike him with the rod, he will not die. You shall strike him with the rod and rescue his soul from Sheol.
All right, so what can we do here as a parent? Or what's the responsibility we have here as a parent? Discipline. Do children automatically grow up knowing right from wrong? Is it an innate thing? If it is, we wouldn't have a standard, would we?
Actually, the Lord says that foolishness is bound up in the heart.
That's right. They need a little assistance. They need a little assistance. And that's what parents are for. Is it the church's job? Is it the government's job? Unfortunately, I think our society is headed in a direction that the government thinks it's their job to take care of that.
They'll put you in jail for doing your job sometimes.
That's true. All right, that's pretty simple. Let's look at Ephesians 6:4. Everybody's familiar with this passage. What are we talking about here? It's actually addressed to fathers.
Don't provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Kids are going to get mad sometimes. This is causing them to be confused and aggravated and not knowing where they are and tormented about something. You know, if you're wishy-washy or if you get on to it one time and you let it go the next, and you know, but bringing them up in such a way, this is not not such a way that's harsh or, like I say, just on and off, but bringing them up so that they understand and that they have respect for the for you and the reason that you're disciplining them, you know. And it's the father's main responsibility, the mama's too, but in teaching, but you know, to make it a continuing part of their life. Like we were talking about all of the about if they're bullied at school. Well, there's other things like ball games on church night, or other
or on Sunday morning,
or on Sunday morning, and things like that. What kind of decisions, you know, are you going to make? Kids, when the first time you do it, especially, even though they've been taught that we go to church and everything, are you going to compromise right to give in to those kinds of pressures? And because your kid's going to be angry, upset, that he's not going to go play that unless you, and then that's a way to teach and to bring them up to speed about what's important. And that they may be disappointed, but, you know, then they start to understand, and then they can make the decision.
Right. Is everybody here aware that Dylan Moore's high school graduation is on a Sunday morning? And he, you know, if he'd been raised a little differently, what might his reaction have been to his parents saying, you know, discussion about, you know, what are we going to do here?
One time missing, one time won't.
Yeah, that's what the world thinks. What's the big deal?
Right.
It's really sad, I think, that we've come to that. I can't believe it.
Can I say something?
Yeah, sure.
Also, I was, you know, it talks about not provoking your children to wrath. And, you know, when kids are young and going through adolescence, you know, they may come home and be in this bad mood, oh, I don't want to talk to you, you know, I had this horrible day. And instead of the parent getting angry and just, you know, returning anger for anger and, you know, yelling at each other and it's becoming a big dispute, you know, instead nurture and admonish in the Lord, you know, instead of just it turning into a big fight,
right.
You know, try to be nurturing to,
right.
to their
that. What's key there is the parent's attitude.
Right.
You know, the parents have to not be, you know, hot off the,
right.
you know, really easy to react, which goes back to some other things we've been studying, but that's awesome. That's I think that's very important. All right, 1 Timothy 5:8. This says, if anyone does not provide for his own, especially for those of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. What's the responsibility here, parents? It doesn't say specifically parents, but
to care for your own.
Okay, well, but in the context of our lesson, what are parents are supposed
they're
to do?
Your responsibility.
Your children. You're supposed to provide for them.
Yes.
Right. Yes. You don't see this just often in the church, but it does happen when parents. It's just too hard. It's too much work, so they just walk off. Just walk away. And yes, I think it also applies to caring for your parents or any other relatives that need assistance. Excuse me. Okay, anybody I want to add to that? I put Ezekiel 16:44. And the reason I did is because this is a passage that's always stuck with me. As is the mother, so is the daughter. What is that? As is the mother, so is the daughter. That's a, oh, I'm sorry, 16:44. It says there that that's a proverb, which we all know is a general rule. What does that mean exactly?
More than likely going to follow in your footsteps.
Right.
So, you know, it's not taking away, you know,
free moral agency.
Sons and free moral agency. But most is, yeah.
Yes, we know from
a certain way and has a certain mannerism about her.
Right.
And we even see the DNA coming out. You know, the older I get, the more I look like my mama. You know,
mm-hmm.
and I catch myself with the mannerisms and everything.
That you never noticed before until you got older. Yeah, I know.
I
I hope I have the faith that she had, you know, and so, but...
It's just a heavy thing, I think, to carry in your heart that your children are watching you. You know, our children are watching us. They're, you know, they're absorbing things whether you like it or not. And they're not only going to absorb the good things you do, but they're going to take in the bad. And they're going to see Mama doing it, especially at a young age. You know, we've all seen our children imitate us. One time I was cleaning the bathroom, and I walked out of there and in the bedroom, and Alyssa had gotten hold of some cleaner and was cleaning a piece of furniture with some kind of... cleaner for tubs, you know, sinks. And she just doing what Mama was doing. She thought she was helping. And it was really sweet. Unfortunately, I didn't react sweetly. I've always felt guilty over that because I was so upset she was using it on wood. But if I stopped to think about it, I would have realized that she was mimicking my behavior. And, you know, instead of getting mad, I should have said, oh, you're so nice to help me. Why don't you come in here and clean this? So... And it's not just our physical actions. It's the way we talk. It's the way we think a lot of times about things and the way we deal with situations, other people. And the fact that we go to church, you know, are they going to go to church on their own? No. They have to have somebody take them when they're that age. Yes, ma'am.
There's a phrase that probably comes to me, see if you're like mother, like daughter.
That's what we're just talking about.
I know. I'm saying that's probably where that came from.
I said that. Ezekiel 16:44. Okay. Did you go to sleep? Yeah, and I had to really do some work to find that. I thought it was in chapter 33. I finally had to get online because I don't have a bound concordance. And, you know, we know that, as Linda said a while ago, that doesn't take away free moral agency because two chapters later, which I put over here under number 4, is Ezekiel 18, where it talks about the son shall not bear the sins of the father and the father shall not bear the sins of the son. You know, we know, I mean, it's clear as day. There's no question about that. Okay, anybody else have a scripture they put here?
I have Galatians 4, 1 and 2. It talks about, now I see a son who can bear the child. He does not differ at all from a slave, although he's an owner of everything, but he is under guardian and manager until the date set by his father. It's kind of an unusual one. Mm-hmm. But I thought, you know, it shows that the parent is responsible for their
And I think another point here in this passage is that the parent has the authority. They have control over that child until the time is appointed by the father for them to be out on their own. So sometimes, you know, obviously that's a thing that kids need to learn, that, you know, they don't become 15 and know everything and ready to support themselves. They think they do. But parents need to remember that too, that, you know, that they are in charge. They are a guardian and a steward until that child is grown, and they've got a lot of responsibility connected to that.
I put 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 7 and verse 11. And this is Paul's wonderful letter to the Thessalonians. In chapter 2, verse 7, he says, maybe he's talking about himself when he was there, prove to be gentle among you as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children. That's sort of what Lisa was talking about all ago. You know, so that's how he was to be gentle, tenderly caring for. Verse 11. Just as you know how we were exhorting, encouraging, imploring each of you as a father would his own children. So, you know, this is the way Paul and their father in the gospel, but, you know, treated them as his children. He loved them. He tenderly cared for them. But yet, when they needed it, he rebuked. When they needed encouraging, he encouraged. And when they needed imploring, you know, begging, you know, please, you know, even, you know, I implore you to do right.
Well, I think this is a good one to include because everything else we've been talking about is discipline and rebuking and making sure when they do wrong that you fix it. This one shows, you know, that the tenderness and the gentleness that a parent shows toward their child. Obviously, the child is going to grow up messed up if they don't have that. If they don't have love and connection to their parents. Okay. Well, what steps can we take to ensure that our children have the tools they need to develop their own faith and live godly lives? This is fairly subjective, so what y'all put here?
Well,
What can I do personally? I'm sorry.
The things that we've been talking about, taking them to church, disciplining them. Show them the examples that they should live. And also, I guess, be able to explain when you've done wrong to them that, I did wrong.
Apologize if necessary. Well, everything we've been talking about leads up to this, but you mentioned being an example. You can't expect them to model your godly behavior, to have godly behavior, if you don't model it for them. You're their main example, especially when they're very young. Before they start to school, then they've got all kinds of worldly examples.
Just to expand on what you're saying, when I'm teaching, even here at church, but especially when I was teaching in the world, every time a child was a huge distraction or had a really bad attitude or really bad reactions to anything in the class, it was a thing that was a consistent.
Mm-hmm. Not just every once in a while.
Yeah, not every once, just something that would happen consistently. When I would start to talk to the parents, I always found out there was something wrong in the home. Usually it was the way the parents treated each other, just yelling at each other, the mother running. Anger or depression, maybe a mother's not even attending to her children like she should. I'm just like, every time. To me, it's just so, like, it just really much in my voice because it was like God gave me this precious, precious gift of a child. And here you are messing it up. And I don't understand how people can be so selfish with their children to think that their children are not trying to be affected by their own.
I think people have children, they don't think past the precious, cute little baby that lays there and doesn't do anything, doesn't even talk back, doesn't do anything. And then when the child grows and becomes somebody who needs a lot of care and a lot of attention and a lot of time, they don't know what to do because they're so self-focused. And that's a sad situation, obviously. But I agree with you. It's a shame, and it goes back to my theme song, Philippians 2, put others above yourself, even your children. I've talked to both my kids about how being a mother is a sacrificial job. You've got to put the kids first. You don't get to do everything you wanted to do, maybe, because you chose to have these children. You got to take care of them. Not that they're not. I didn't mean that, but... another thing you said, Amanda, reminded me of discipline. I put down to expect correct behavior. Define what the boundaries are, what the rules are, and then expect them to stick to it. You can't just, aren't they cute? We're going to have to deal with that one of these days. That is not an attitude that's in the best interest of the child. And does anybody disagree with me? I mean, I'm kind of preaching now, but...
Well, I think that goes along with... They have to know what you expect, because if they don't,
right, they're going to be confused.
They're going to mess up.
Yeah.
And when you get on to them for messing up,
they don't know why.
They don't. Yeah.
Right. I have a cousin that told me one time she came home from first grade and was just talking away, and she said a cuss word. I don't even remember now what it was. And my uncle picked her up, threw her over his knee, and wore her out. She didn't even know why. She didn't know it was a bad word. And then of course when they talked, he felt terrible. So that's a great, great point.
And that goes back to 6:4 there, I think, and it's mm-hmm. About the fathers and the anger. They don't teach, right. They just react.
Well, but in this case, I don't think it ever entered his head that a 6-year-old would learn that word anywhere.
Right.
Sometimes it's things happen that you're not prepared for. And how do you prepare your child for that? How do you say, don't ever say these words? Then you got to tell them. They're going to hear them eventually.
When we went to first grade, we probably never would have heard that word.
I remember a second grade word that I heard. I was just, I went home and asked my mother what it was.
Well, I never heard those words.
So yeah, I was not, I was
today,
shocked.
I think they're going to hear it going to pre-K.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, they are.
They're
are.
Just going to hear those words. They're just so.
They're everywhere. Prevalent. I mean, they can be in Target and hear the words. They don't have to go to school.
That's true.
Okay, I think we should stop unless y'all want to say anything else on this. Oh, I did put also allow them to suffer the consequences. If we set rules and then we don't follow through, what are we telling them? Yeah, you'll get away. I can get away with that, so why not repeat the behavior? And then another one I had is don't rely on Bible classes to be your child's sole spiritual education. Yeah, they're going to learn something in the classes, but who is charged with training and bringing their children up in the admonition of the word? We all know the answer to that.
Put down, discuss their Bible lessons with them. Mm-hmm. And the service.
Right. Day. Don't just make sure they fill out all the answers. Right. That's a great idea. You know, get in the car on the way home and talk about it.
Yeah, and along that, I put down, have them read to you and pray together and have them participate too. And, you know, in the prayer life and the studying and reading the Bible, just sitting down and reading the Bible and have them read it to you and then talk about it. You know, that's something that sometimes we don't make time in our schedule for. We make time to get the Bible lessons, but just, especially if they've had a bad day, if they have misbehaved in some way, sit down. It takes time and discipline on ourselves.
It does.
But then, right then, you know, as part of the discipline.
If you do that, the rewards are great.
It is.
They really are. We need to stop, but before we do, look over at the next lesson, which is about submission. And on the second page, number 3, what that I should say is, how do each of the following illustrate attitudes necessary to submission? That was kind of bizarre wording there. Just want to make sure you understand I want to know about the attitudes. Okay?
Well,